Tror du han svarer nei? All feeling well? Good. Different place? Different people? Or same person? Different person. Are you sure? How do you feel though? Same person, different place? Or different person, same place? Or different person, different place? Or same person, same place? It's up to you to work it out, huh? Different person, different place. Okay. The thing is, different people will feel about it the different ways as well, won't they? Is it a different place or is it a different person? Is it the same person? On the outset it seems like it's the same person but a different place, isn't it? So on the way here, Anagarika Putra who holds the umbrella, he was asking me, Swaminathan, so don't you feel like different, like normally you do the sermon in the library building, today you're going to do it in this particular building. Do you feel anything odd, unusual about it? I said, where's the library? He said, oh, that's the first time I saw the library. I've never seen the library before. So I don't feel any different. But what do I mean by that? Had I seen the library before? The previous place where I do the sermon, had we seen that before? Had we? No. Why not? Because, of course, it's a brand new citta, isn't it? If it's a brand new citta, then it was the first time in samsara that I saw the library. Hello, strangers. Have we met before? Do we know each other? Why are you looking at me like I'm so familiar to you? We've never met before. A bunch of strangers, a new place. Everything's new today. But it requires us to think in those terms. And when we do that, ladies and gentlemen, it becomes, you know, then you have nothing to cling on to. When you realize that all there is are manifestations, what do you cling on to? What do you like or dislike? To have a friend, you need to have someone you've known for some time, right? Think about it for a second. To be friends with someone, you know, to have that emotional connection with someone, you need to have known them for some time. As, you know, people date before they get married. So in the throughout the dating process, you get to know each other. So you begin to realize that this is the person, you understand their flaws, their weaknesses, their strengths, yeah? You try to understand the other person, you get to know the other person. And hopefully that is a mutual process, is what people hope for. But then you tie the knot and then soon enough you realize that is not the person I got married to. Does this sound like something you've never heard before? It's the same old story. So who here got married to the same person that they knew before getting married to them? No one. So you dated one person, or rather you got to know, you saw that one person for the very first time. Then you started dating a different person. Yeah? You started going out with a different person, going to the restaurants with a different person. You spent Valentine's Day with a different person. Your first kiss was with a different person. Yeah? And you held hands of a very different person. And ultimately, you got onto the porva with a different person and you got off the porva. How flippant you are. How promiscuous you are. So who here has ever committed themselves to one individual? People claim that, right? I've only loved one person in my whole life. Yeah? People say that. I've only ever loved one person in my whole life. I've always been very faithful. I'm not the kind of girl who goes out with everybody, right? I'm very honest, I'm very committed, I'm very dedicated to one individual. Who here can actually claim that they have been so? No one. Why is that? Because that is not the truth. That's why. The truth is, you can never hold on to something. Now then, when people say, Buddhism is about letting go. Letting go of what? Huh? I'm about to let go of this. Is this the same thing I picked up a moment ago? Is it? Then what do I have to let go? What is there to let go? What is impermanence then? How long did this last to become impermanent? Impermanence is a function of time. In a world that is akalika, that is timeless, how can you speak of impermanence? These are the truths, the realities that we are now beginning to understand. And once you grasp these truths, ladies and gentlemen, these are the age-old truths. They've always been true, regardless of whether you and I accept them or not. If you accept them, you can live happily. If you deny them, then you suffer. It's simple as that. Whether we accept it or not doesn't make any difference to the outside world. So are you here to let go? That's why right from the beginning, we've been saying, Buddhism is not about letting go. Because when people think that Buddhism is about letting go, they get really paranoid. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I can't let go of all these things. My family, my children, my parents, my treasures, my wealth, my car, my pet, Tommy, how can I let go? How can I let go? He's the one who kept me company in the good times and bad. How can I let go? How can I let go of my prized possessions? How can I let go of our family heirloom? How? This is the ring my grandmother gave me. She wore it for her wedding. How can I let go? People have all sorts of questions. They have these problems. So they struggle to let go. And then they think Buddhism is about letting go. That's why people are scared of walking into a temple. Because they worry that the Swami Nuance they meet is going to say, let go, Pingvata, let go. Not so. That is not the truth. The truth is, you just need to realize that there is nothing to let go of. See, I love the fact that in Buddhist philosophy, there's only one thing to do. And that is to open your eyes and wake up from the dream that you're in. Simple as that. When you're having a nightmare and there are elephants chasing after you. Or say Tarzan, who's swinging from branch to branch, trying to come to get you. Or you seem like you're drowning in a vast ocean, and there's no one to save you. You're in a dream. What's the one thing you have to do to get out of all of these? Wake up. That's it. Wake up and then what? There are 100 elephants chasing after you with their tuskers and their trunks, right? They look... they're enormous. And if they get you, they're going to tear you down. 100 elephants chasing after you. You have to wake up and then do what? And then do what? Nothing. This is why Buddhist philosophy is so powerful. You just have to realize. Realization is bliss. Something ignorance is. But realization is bliss. The ultimate bliss is the realization. And that is what our great master did under that Bodhi tree. All those paramitas that he fulfilled, ladies and gentlemen, you know, over those many incalculable yawns, was so that his realization could happen. Unfortunately, he had no teacher. Just imagine that. Just imagine trying to understand all this without a teacher. Today, sometimes we struggle even with a teacher. Yeah? How many times a week do you come to the monastery? Understanding sometimes these principles for the simple reason that we've never looked at life in this way. That's the only reason. We are not used to looking at the truths in this way. We've always lived in a dream. So to think of life as a real thing, as the real deal, we're not used to it. And then, and still, just think of how many times a week you have to come to the monastery. Even with a teacher, I have had to make myself a permanent resident of the monastery to understand the truth. Even with a teacher, most of you come to the monastery 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week. You have shifted and you have moved and relocated to, you know, dwellings around the monastery. All for what? Because you want to be with Guru Andhru. Or because you want to understand the truth. It's because you want to understand the truth. That's why. Remember when you wanted to get your child into a good school? Right? If the school was in Colombo and you lived in Thoothukudi, what did you do? That you, let's just say, forged the documents, right? Or you got to, you know, found someone you know, right? And then pretended that that is where you were resident because you wanted to get your child into a good school, yeah? So why have you been moving closer to the monastery? Because you want to get your child into a good school, yes. Into a good school, absolutely. Because here, in this school, we teach the truth. Exclusively for aspirants of what? The truth, well done. That is what Dedana Ramayar is. Exclusively for aspirants of the truth. You can call it Nibbana if you want to. If Nibbana is not the truth, let's all go home. We don't need Nibbana. We just need the truth. The truth is the call to wake up from our dreams and see things as they really are. Then you realize that there is nothing to let go of. Because letting go is a very, very, very difficult thing to do. Who here disagrees with me? How much did you struggle to let go of your children? If you have done that already. How many of you struggle to, I mean, you've been trying, but you still can't let go of your children. Some have physically let go of them, but mentally you are still attached to them. See how difficult letting go is? The physical letting go is okay. You know, when you die, it's done. But mental letting go doesn't even happen even when you die. It's still there. That's why you keep coming back for unfinished business. Just think about how difficult it has been to let go, for some of you, your lay lives. You know, when you decided that you wanted to move closer to the monastery, just think about all the things that you had to go through, that shopping list of things. Yeah, your property, your, I don't know, whatever, your parents and your friends, your work, the things that you had worked so hard to build up for yourselves. Just walk through that, you know, through those steps that you took, getting to where you are today. All those letting goes, if you deliberately let go of them, that would have been incredibly difficult. Because, you know, there is no such thing called letting go. There isn't. You can't forcefully let go. If you're attached to this and it's in your hand, you drop it. You think you've let go of that. You think you've let go of that. Just imagine I'm attached to this. I put it to a side. I even look away. I promise to myself I'll never look at it again. Do you think I've let go of this? Because if that is letting go, where's your car right now? Where's your car right now? Are you sitting in it? Where's your house right now? I mean, if you're a resident here, don't answer that question. You're at home. But, you know, if you've come from home and your home is somewhere outside these two gates, right, where's your home right now? It's somewhere else, right? Not here. Maybe it's somewhere in Colombo City. So if that is letting go, then you've already let go. We let go all day, all the time. Your favorite item of jewelry, have you got that on you right now? It's your favorite item of jewelry. Your mother passed it down to you. It has been passed down from generation to generation. Is it with you right now? No, because today you want to observe Dasasil, so you leave it at home and come. Yeah? Have you let go? If this is letting go, then you have already let go of a lot of things. But no, that is not what letting go is. So when people think about letting go physically, we need to get over that. We need to get over the thinking that that is what letting go is. It's not. Physical letting go is not letting go at all. It's so overrated. Even when someone says, you know, I let go of my lay life, I have become a monk, right? Now, those days I used to live in a palace, but today I go and live as a hermit. I live in a cave, I live in a small kuti. But from time to time I do think about my old life, right? And I sometimes look up at the sky and wonder if only things had been different. Or maybe I came to the sasana too early. If only I'd stayed another 5 years, I could have fulfilled my dreams. I was just on the verge of becoming a millionaire. Maybe I was a bit too early. Do you think this man has let go? It looks like he has. Yeah, because all he has on him is a robe. It looks like he has. Or if you have a monk or a hermit or whoever takes his arms, goes on arms round, right? People serve him leftovers. And then he thinks to himself, oh, you know, life didn't used to be like this. I thought monkhood was going to be a bit more comfortable than this. I thought monkhood would give me delightful food. It would give me, I thought devotees would offer good things to me, tasteful food to me. I thought delightful people would offer to me delicious food. But look at this. Is this the kind of food that I have to now live with for the rest of my life? On the outset, it looks like he's let go. But has he? He's not even thought of letting go yet. Because letting go is all a mental process. There is nothing to let go. Even mentally, you can't let go. You can't let go. You just have to realize. That's the only thing you can do. This is why we revere the Buddha. You know, before you bring your palms together in veneration of his holy name, I need you to recognize, ladies and gentlemen, why we do that. Because that is what's important. Do you remember when you were young children, you know, just kids, our parents used to take us to visit our grandparents. Yeah? And then they would say, Putta, worship. Did you know why we were doing it? When you were just a kid, you didn't know why you were doing it. Go worship this, you worship Achyama. This was the time even before you knew that, you know, your mother and your father were the two people who brought you up into this world, who brought you into this world, right? And who looked after you, who fed you, who taught you, and did everything. So if you didn't know that this is your parents were them, then how would you know what your grandparents would have done for you? But they would have asked you, your parents would have asked you, you know, go worship your Achyama. You did it just because. Remember, you've not seen, like for the almsgivings and so on, when really, really, you know, really little children come into the monastery, the parents, what they do is they bring the child, they bring the hands together in front of the monk, right? And put that, say sadhu putta. The little guy doesn't know what he's doing. He's just following suit. When he sees his father getting on his knees, the child also does that. And he sees the father adjusting himself so that he's facing the Buddha statue. The child also does that. That's not through understanding. That's just repeating what you see. But when we bring our palms together in veneration of the Buddha, we needn't do that. Because that brings us very little reward. Now for the last 7 days, right, you have all been getting involved in this great pinkama that we have. Depositing relics into the relic chamber of the new pagoda, unveiling the pagoda, and the processions that we've been having, offering the Gilampasa Puja, the Buddha Puja, and so on. That you've all been engaging in so many meritorious deeds, and today we have the finale of that. But that won't end here. The ceremonies will end. The festivities will end. But if you have understood what the chaitya, the stupa, the pagoda represents, then the pinkama doesn't end today. If you think it's just the unveiling of a stupa, of the spire, if you think it's just the depositing of relics into a relic chamber and then sealing it off, that is the pinkama, then that is done and that's done. That's it. It's never going to be done again, once in a lifetime. But if you understand what the stupa is all about, what the relics are about, then that pinkama never ends. So if you understand what the Buddha is about, when you bring your palms together in veneration, rather than who it is, what it is you are venerating, then that's going to be there with you forever. Because if it's a who you're worshipping, then we are already too late for that, aren't we? Just 2,500 years too late for that. Because that man is gone. He's not there for us to worship today. He's not there for us to offer the Buddha Puja today. But every day we do a Buddha Puja. People would ask, you know, why do you offer a Buddha Puja to a statue? That's either fiber or cement or plastic. Why do you do that? And the problem there is because you see the food and you see the statue. Because the realization hasn't happened yet. Because then it makes no sense. Offering food to a statue makes no sense. But once you realize that what you're offering is not really the food, it's only a representation. It represents something. It represents nourishment. It represents vitality. It represents energy. It represents effort. It represents wisdom. Ayuvanna, sapa, bala, patibhana. It represents these things. And when you recognize that the stupa or the Buddha statue represents Nibbana, now that is a timeless offering, isn't it? When does that pinkama come to an end? It never does. Even after you have become a Buddha, as in an Arahata Buddha, if we had Arahatan Vahanses at the monastery, even they would get involved. They would go and offer the Buddha Puja. In fact, you know, they'd probably say, I will do the Buddha Puja. You go practice, do your meditation, listen to the Dhamma. They might say that. So I think it's very important that whenever we take a moment to worship the Buddha, we need to remind ourselves that the Buddha is not the man who lived 2,500 years ago. Conventionally, yes, but he represented all that was good about the Buddha. Because once we recognize that, folks, now that becomes a timeless veneration. Otherwise, we are 2,500 years too late. Then you have to wait until the Maitri Buddha comes around. But if you recognize that Buddha is Nibbana, then how long does Nibbana last? Forever. Because Nibbana is an asankata. The Buddha's body is a sankata. The Buddha's mind is also a sankata. Sabbe sankara anicchati. They're all manifestations. Those manifestations will only manifest for as long as the causes manifest. But Nibbana is not a sankara. Sabba sankara, samatha is Nibbana. Therefore, it is timeless. It lasts forever. So it is a timeless sublimeness that today I ask to bring your palms together in veneration of. So when we do so, I want you to reflect on this, that it is not merely the Gautama Buddha to whom you make this veneration. You have to realize through wisdom and insight that this is Nibbana, what the Buddha stood for, what he represented, what he walked the surface of this earth for 45 long years to convince us of, and all sentient beings. Nibbana, that is the ultimate bliss. And so, to that ultimate bliss, we make this veneration.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
So now that you have made your veneration to that, you need to become that. That is what a veneration actually means. You know the Sinhalese word for veneration, making a worship, is vandana. Yes. What that means is to wash away the ignorance, to dispel ignorance, to dispel blindness. When you're blind, what is the state of affairs? You can't see. So when you dispel blindness or ignorance, now what happens? You see. That's what happens. Now, I'm sure most, if not all of you, will have, on many occasions by this point, gone into the shrine room and done the Buddhaguna Sajjayana and so on, right? Let's take one of them. Arahang. Arahang is a virtue. So when you go into the shrine room, you chant the Nava Arahadi Buddhaguna, meaning there are 9 of them, but there are infinite. There's an infinite number of virtues, but thankfully the Buddha encapsulated all that into 9 qualities or virtues, and only the Buddha could do that, to be honest. Imagine asking us to encapsulate all or capture all of the qualities into X number. So the Buddha did that on our behalf so that we have today the Itipi, So Bhagava, Arahang and so on. When you go into the shrine room, you will chant this. In fact, you know, you don't need to go all the way Itipi, So Bhagava, Arahang, Samma, Sambuddha. What if you just went in there and said Arahang, 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 Arahang? Is that not Buddha Guna chanting? No, of course. Samma Sambuddho, Samma Sambuddho, Samma Sambuddho. Is that not Buddha Guna chanting? Lokavidu, 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 Lokavidu. Do you have to say all 9 of them? No. Do you have to say any of them? Certainly, leave alone 9 of them. Do you have to actually say, like speak out, pronounce any of them? No. Because then there's a speaker in there that does it. That does a fine job, never stops. You guys, you start and stop when you get tired, when you need to use the washroom. Right? But that speaker there, it's been running ever since we switched it on. All you got to do is change batteries from time to time. It never stops. So then it must have attained arahathood by now. Do you think the speaker is doing a worship? I don't mean the speaker of the... I'm talking about the speaker. Not that speaker, okay? Parliamentarian speaker. Yeah. These days, that's, you know, you could mistake me for saying that. We've had a lot of people come and go. You're probably thinking the speaker is in the shrine room. He's not. I speak of the speaker, the speaker, buffalo speaker. So, this speaker... That's not a worship. Because a worship or a veneration is about dispelling blindness. That is what a vandana is. So when you take, for example, Arahant, your vandana of Arahant, your veneration of Arahant must lead you to this. And what is that? You have to become Arahant. That is your worship. It is worthy of becoming. That is a worship. If something is worth worshipping, is it not worthy of becoming? Now you worship your parents. Yeah? You worship your parents because of their virtues, right? Because of their qualities, because of how good they are and great they are to you as a mother or a father. So when you worship them, when you worship your teachers, when you worship the Mahasangha, I mean, do you go and worship like rocks and mountains and trees? People used to do that back then. But you don't do that now, do you? Why is that? Why don't you go and worship mountains and rocks? Why don't you do that? Because you have no need to become like them. Anything you worship, don't you wish you could be more like them? Unless you are doing it because that has to be done. You know, in some situations, you're just doing it because it has to be done. But if you're doing it honestly and genuinely, you really, really, really want to do it, whenever you worship someone, like take Guru Handra for example. Right? At the end of the sermons, we worship Guru Handra. Don't we all wish we could become a little bit more like him? Isn't that why we worship Guru Handra? Is it just because he's given a splendid sermon? Then you should worship the speaker again. Because you only hear him speak through the speakers. Then you should worship, you know, say you maybe at home, as you listen to the sermons at home, you know, on occasions when you can't come to the monastery, maybe you listen to it on your laptop. Now what is the gatha you use to worship the laptop? Okasavandami laptop. But perhaps there are those among you who still do the worship at home even after listening to the sermon. Okasa vandami bhante. But that's not the laptop you're worshipping. Do you want to become more like a laptop? More flexible? No. What you want to become, you worship. So worshipping is our attestation. That we want to become more like the object that we worship. Those days when people used to think that the sun and the moon and the stars and the rocks and the trees, you know, they were all deities. Those days, you know, people didn't really want to become deities, but they wanted favors from the deities. They wanted the deities to look after them, to protect them. And they thought if we worship the deities, then they would be happy. And when they're happy, they would look after me. We call it santosa. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. It was that principle. We worship the deities. The deities are happy, now they look after us. You give them, make them offering, sacrificial offerings. Yeah, people make sacrificial offerings. They sacrifice animals to please the gods. When the gods are happy, what do people suppose they do? They look after you. They protect you. They give you wealth. Right? They give you shelter. They give you a good life. So this is what people thought. Now you see, when you worship the Buddha, what is the Buddha going to give you? What does the Buddha have to give you? If you worship a deity, maybe you know the deity has a weapon of some sort. Maybe he has a special power. Maybe he can teleport you. Say if you're in a difficult place, you know, you're walking down the street and you're about to be run into by a car, right? A deity, perhaps if you please them enough, maybe they can teleport you. Right? Disappear and appear. So the deity has done that for you because you have made them happy. What can the Buddha do for you? I mean now, let's say 2,500 years ago he was there, he had supernatural powers, let's just assume that he did. But now what is the point of worshipping him? I really want you all to think about this, ladies and gentlemen. You know why I'm sharing this stuff with you? And it's not just with you, but also with people who are listening to these talks online as well. Some of you already understand some of these concepts. But much of the world, you know, they're set in their ways of thinking. They're very close and narrow-minded. They don't open themselves up to other possibilities. Because we live in a physical world, The ideas and thoughts that have been instilled in our minds is what you see is there, what you hear is there, but nothing else exists. So therefore, it's quite right that people question, why do you worship the Buddha? In other religions, like say Christianity, God is always there. God is timeless. If you take Islam, for instance, Allah is always there. He's been there even before us. He's always been there and He will always be there. So because He will always be there, God Almighty will always be there, they'll always be there to protect us, won't they? And that is what they believe. They'll always be there to provide for us. If we are good, then they'll be pleased by our good behavior, by our good demeanor. So they will protect us, they will love us. And if we can win their love, win their respect, or rather win their heart, then God will always guide me. He will be my shepherd and I will be His lamb. But how can you do the same with Buddha? Now we have a problem. Where is the Buddha to protect you today? See, just think for a second. You know, we deposit the dhatu or the relics in the dhatu garbe, the relic chamber. If you are like me, you must have an answer to the question, why do we do that? Otherwise, you're just blind followers. I don't think Nibbana works like that. I've never been one who subscribed to blind faith. If I don't see rhyme and reason in why I do something, I just don't do it. I don't mean adamantly. If someone says I have to do it, I do it. I'm not difficult like that. Honestly, I'm not difficult like that. But what I mean is, for it to bring us something, for it to bring us some fulfillment, for it to actually give us something meaningful and add something to our lives, don't you think you need to understand what you're doing? Yeah? You see, if we built a temple for God Shiva, let's just say, Lord Shiva is timeless. He's there today and He will always be there. He's the creator and He's the destroyer. In the Hindu religion, that is what they say. So one day He's going to open His third eye. And once He opens His third eye, the whole world and all worldly systems as we understand it can and will be destroyed. But He was also the creator. He created the world. So if He created the world and if He's going to destroy the world, He must be there when the world is destroyed, right? I mean, He's not like the LTT. He doesn't commit suicide. He's there. But the world is destroyed. He's not a suicide bomber. He'll be there. So Lord Shiva will always be there. Lord Vishnu is always going to be there. Lord Krishna, He's always going to be there. Lord Hanuman, always going to be there. So it makes sense to build stupas in their name to please them. It makes sense. I understand that. That I understand. Because they're always there. It makes sense to build a temple in the name of Allah. It makes sense to put up a cross in the name of God Almighty because He's always going to be there. He's always going to be there watching over me, to protect me, to safeguard me. But what's the point of building a stupa in the name of the Buddha? Huh? What's the point? Don't you think we've just wasted all our time and effort? And then we go deposit the relics in there. Why worship the relics? I mean, these are the remains of dead bodies. Aren't they? You know, if I could bring to you a strand of hair that belongs to God, you know, I understand if people would want to worship that. Why? Because God would probably be happy that we are worshipping His relics. Actually, they won't be relics then, because He'll still be around. And we can please Him by doing so. But what's the point of worshipping the Sarvajna Dhatu? What's the point? Whose good books are you going to get into? You think he's going to send you a Christmas card? You're not even going to get something as much as a Christmas card. But if you're good, on Christmas Day, God will send Santa and you will get presents. But what is the Buddha going to give you? Nothing at all. Why? He's not here. So if he's not here, why are we wasting our time? Just Guru Hamdra said so. Don't be blind followers. No point in doing that. If you have come here because you say you want to see the truth, yeah, then you can't just be doing things because Guru Hamdra says so. Because one day he might just tease you. He might just mock you. He might just say something that you can't believe. Or that you will believe, but that is not true. You have to become a student of nature. We talked about this last Poya day. That is what the Buddha did. He became a student of nature. Although we say he had no teacher, he says the Dhamma is my teacher. What is the Dhamma? Nature. Sobha? Dhamma. That's nature. The Dhamma was his teacher, meaning nature was his teacher, meaning he just became so sensitive. He became so attuned to nature that the lessons that nature taught and has always been teaching, he realized. And then he became the Buddha. So when you worship, when you walk up, you know, now it's quite hot sometimes. If you've been standing in those queues, you know, it gets very hot. If you have one of those relic chambers in your hand, then someone's holding an umbrella for you. Otherwise, I ask you, for what? Do they give you soft drinks up there? No. So for what then? Do they give you a trophy? Do you get a certificate? Now for what then? Why do you put yourself through this? Isn't it also like Dushkarakriya? Huh? Just think about what you're doing in the time of the pandemic. Yeah, when COVID-19 was really big. There were people, maybe some among you as well, who would travel from the other side of the country. Either on their private transport or they would get into public transport. They would catch 3 buses and 2 trains to come to the monastery. Just the outside, they would get on their knees. They'd worship in the direction of the monastery. They might bring something to offer to the Mahasangha. They would leave it by the entrance and they would go back home. 2 buses and 3 trains. Don't you think that is like a Dushkarakriya? What did they get out of it? You can see what they spent. Right? They had to pay the fare to get here. And if they brought something with them, they had to carry that with them. Then they left it by the gate. Yeah? No one to accept it from them. No one to even say, give an ashirwad, a blessing. Then they turned around and they went back. Those days we used to share those stories with you. I've seen plenty of videos captured on the CCTV cameras outside of people who used to come up to the monastery. They'd bring with them whatever gifts they could carry in their little hands all the way from wherever. Those days, you know, there were curfews and so on as well. Some of them would go and speak to the authorities and get special permissions just to bring some rations to the monastery. Oh my, these people are crazy. Crazy people. I don't know, you're crazy. If you did that for Lord Shiva, he would look after you. He would keep you safe on the way back home. Wouldn't he? Go to the temple, make an offering to Lord Shiva, right? And beseech. Oh dear Lord, I have come here today and made all my offerings to you. Please guide me. Please protect me. You are the protector. I surrender myself to you. I worship myself at your feet. I offer myself at your feet. Convinced that Lord Shiva has heard my prayer, I turn around and I walk out. But feeling strong inside, feeling a sense of protection inside, because I know that Lord Shiva has heard my prayer and now he's going to look after, he's going to protect me. But when you came and left those things at the monastery's gate, sometimes it was a day later, we would see on the camera. So there was no Swami Nuhan says to bless you on your way back home. And what if on the way back home, you know, they got into an accident? If someone goes to the temple on the way back home, get into an accident, they don't say that was Lord Shiva's doing. That they don't say, because Lord Shiva always protects me. But if someone comes to the monastery on their way back home, they get run over. Now the Swami Nuhan says, don't even give me their blessings. So once again, I have to ask you the question. Are you crazy or are you crazy? Which one? If you don't understand why you do these things, you're just a blind follower. Blind followers don't go very far in the Buddha's asana. I mean, not that they get led astray. It comes to a point, you know, where you have to stop. To make progress from there on, as you enter the realm of insight, you have to start to answer these questions for yourself. You need answers. Because the realm of wisdom, it requires you to walk in with your eyes open. So you need to understand what you have been doing over the last 7 days. Today is the last day, the 8th day of these processions. You need to know what you're doing. Because you'll be walking up there today as well. You'll have some offering in your hand, maybe some flowers, maybe some gilampasa, maybe some water, maybe some joss sticks, maybe an oil lamp. You will walk up those steps, knowing perhaps that this is the last time you'll be seeing the pagoda in that way. You may also have something to offer to the pagoda, perhaps. And then today they're going to seal it shut. You may have already deposited your copper leaves. If you haven't, you will get a chance to do that. And then, every day you come into the monastery, as you walk through these gates, you'll probably look up and see the pagoda shining bright. You'll bring your hands together and you will chant a sadhukara. But who's going to hear your prayer? There are no deities in the Devata Kotu, I can tell you that much. I haven't seen any anyway. Maybe there are, but I haven't seen any. I haven't seen any special lights emanating from the pinnacle. Do we expect that? No, we didn't expect that. Some might even question, what about the Dhatu? Are they genuine ones? Because there are a lot of fake ones out there. So what are we supposed to do? Carbon dating and test them? Which of them belong to Bakkula Maharatanmas? Which of them belong to Sariputta Maharatanmas? Which of them belong to actually the Supreme One? You think we've tested any of the relics that people have been bringing in over the last few days? Huh? If so, you have to test whether the Buddha is in this statue also. You hear me? If you have to test whether those relics are the relics of the actual Arahatan Mahanses or the Buddha, then before you worship this statue, you have to check whether the Buddha is there as well. Do you? No. So what if they're fake? What if all of them are fake? Someone said me at last count, they had almost 90 Dhatunvansi. And someone else said, you know, today, Swaminathan said, the miracles are happening. Today we see 90, the next morning we come and see, even with the no devotees coming in, then there are 100. Dhatunvansis keep appearing from nowhere. So people come and ask me, sir, how is this happening? How do you explain these miracles? Is this real? Or is someone walking in that night and depositing them? So that we have a nice story to tell our devotees and impress them. How do these miracles happen? It's a bit like asking, where was the Buddha born? Where was the Buddha born? Where was the Buddha born? Yes. So what is the miracle that has happened? What is the miracle that keeps happening every day in this monastery? Where is it happening? Yes. Where is it happening? In the stupa. Yes. Where is that stupa? It's here. This is the chaitya. So you don't need to go and check whether those Dhatunvansis are genuine ones. Who cares if they're just fragments of glass? Do you think we will make any less of a worship or an offering if we figured out that they were fragments of glass? No, because those worships, those venerations, those offerings, they're not made to material things. Because, you know, we've gone far beyond that, all of us. That is why today it matters not what this statue is made out of. In fact, if I took the head off of this statue, would you not worship it again? Say the statue fell on the floor and broke at the neck. Right? Now we have the statue and put the head by the side. When you worship, won't you worship the Buddha again? Will you feel like it's no longer the Buddha I'm worshipping? So was it the Buddha you were worshipping before that then? Is this what the Buddha looked like? You can't make statues of what the Buddha looked like. He had the Mahapurusha Lakshana. It is said you can't actually make a statue that resembles the Buddha entirely and represent all 32 of his Mahapurusha Lakshana. It is said that you can't actually create a statue like that. A statue of perfection. You can't do that. Because all statues have flaws, because they're made by people who have flaws. In fact, those days, one of the reasons they didn't make statues for a long period of time in history was because they knew that, you know, you just can't mold a bit of clay to look like the Buddha. But that to aside, the Buddha is just not a bit of clay. So when you worship the stupa, as you walk in every morning, and you bring your hands together, you look up that way, and you make your worship, ladies and gentlemen, you need to understand that what you are aspiring to is to dispel ignorance. That is what a worship actually means. Vandana. To dispel ignorance. If arahang, 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 arahang is all you chant when you go into the shrine room, it even matters not whether you chant it verbally. And even it doesn't even matter whether you recite it mentally. Because just repeating the word arahang is not going to do much for you. I mean, it's not a detergent that washes your mouth. It's not an oral antiseptic. It does nothing. It's just a word. The only way it becomes a kamatahana, the only way it actually does something for you, is when you try to become arahant. So if there's something worthy of your worship, if there's something worthy of your reverence, then it is worthy of you becoming that. That is how we must all understand what a worship means. As good Buddhists? No. As intelligent Buddhists. There are a lot of good Buddhists. As intelligent Buddhists. As Buddhists who go beyond the conventional norms of what being a Buddhist is all about. Are you a conventional Buddhist or are you an intelligent Buddhist? What are you? Because a good Buddhist is a religious man. A conventional Buddhist is a good scientist. A conventional Buddhist is a good religious, is a religious man. An intelligent Buddhist is a good scientist. They're a good student. They have understood nature. So, can't you worship nature? What is it to worship nature? What does that mean? To become nature. What is the Buddha after all? Nature. Why do we suffer? Why do we suffer? Put it very simply. Because you haven't become nature. When your expectations are in conflict with the principles, the laws, the phenomenon of nature, the workings of nature, when your understanding, when your interpretation of the world, when your expectations are in conflict with that, that's when you suffer. All things rise and pass away. I mean, let's take it at a very simple level, because ultimately that is not true either. Things don't rise and pass away. But that's enough for another day. Okay? Let's just say on a very simple level, all things rise and pass away. If your expectation is that they should rise and remain so, what's going to happen? You suffer. If your expectation is that they should pass away but not rise again, then what happens? Again you suffer. But if you can come to terms with nature, accept nature, acknowledge nature, and what's the magic word? Become. In your understanding, if you can become nature, in your understanding, what about your body? What part of the body has to become nature? It is already nature. There is no part of your body that goes against nature, no part of it. So when you have a heart attack, someone gives you a heart transplant, right? Is that not nature now? Or someone gives you an artificial heart, is that no longer nature? Is plastic not nature? It's nature. Everything is nature. So how come people say that you're polluting nature by dropping plastic and polythene and so on? You can't pollute nature. Because everything is nature. How can you pollute nature? Now the environmental activists will be activated upon hearing this sermon. I think I'm asking for trouble now. They'll be queuing up outside next day. Not just the villagers. But you know, you have to, we've got to be on another level to understand what I mean here. This is not mundane dhamma. This is not just a Jataka Katha, right? This is the Jataka Katha. It is the story of the Jati. You can call it the Jatika Katha if you want. We must become one with nature, ladies and gentlemen. They say God created the world and everything. I love that saying. I love it. Because what that says is, what that means to me is, God is nature. I love that. Because it gives me something to aspire to. Here, I have found a philosophy that teaches me how to become God. I don't know any other philosophy that teaches you how to become God. I don't know any other religion that teaches you how to become God. Other religions, other philosophies, I think, with my limited knowledge and understanding of the world, I think they teach you how to get close to God. They teach you how to enter the garden of God. How to be close to God. But that's as close as you can get. That's as close as you can get. If you go and ask someone, how can you become Shiva? The answer is going to be, he is unparalleled. You can't become Shiva. Can you become Allah? No. Don't even think about it. Can you become God Almighty? The One? No. He is the Father. You can't become God. You can't become Krishna. You can't become Shiva. You can't become Lord Hanuman. No other religion will teach you how to become God. But what the Buddha teaches you is how to become God. Because God is nature. If you can become nature, that is what Vandana is. Your worship is to dispel ignorance. Once you dispel ignorance, you become nature. What does that tell you about the state you are right now? Let me put it this way. See, to become nature, all you have to do is realize the truth. Okay? Nothing else needs to change. All you have to do is realize the truth. If all you have to do is realize the truth, then the gap between becoming nature and what you are now is a realization, isn't it? Meaning, perceiving the world in a different way, interpreting the world in a different way, through the lens of the truth. So if that is the only gap between what you are now and becoming nature, aren't you already nature? Because the gap is merely your understanding, your realization. It's a bit like this. You are your mother's child, aren't you? Aren't you all your mother's child? Wait, let me think about it. Huh? You are either your mother's son or your mother's daughter. Yeah? So you are the child of your parents. When you were very, very, very young, when you were just a baby, you didn't know this. Yes? When we were just infants, we didn't know this. So when you were just an infant, if you could speak, this is a hypothetical example. If you could speak and I asked you, who is this person to you? And I showed you your mother, what would you say? Milk feeder. She's my milk bottle. That's what you would have said. And especially if you'd showed it to the father, you probably wouldn't have known at all. Like, I don't know, it doesn't give me anything. He feels warm when he holds me, but besides that, I don't know. Gives me warm. Gives me cuddles. He's a cuddle giver. But you didn't understand them as mother and father, did you? Not in the way that you understand today. Today you understand that a mother is more than someone who just feeds you, right? Because otherwise the cow does the same. She feeds you. But your mother is she's a very special person. She's unique. There are no two of her type. There's only one. And the same goes for father. There's only one. There are no two of her type. Even we know when people say, my wife, she's like a mother to me. She's like a mother to you, yes. But she's not the mother to you. Scratch my back, scratch my back. That's how it works. But the mother is the mother, is the mother, is the mother. She's always the mother. That doesn't change. The father is the father, is the father, is the father. That is the father. That doesn't change. It goes beyond just a biological connection. Now, this is a very two-dimensional story. Otherwise, you say, Swami, no answer. What you said before does not tally with what you're saying now. There are no mothers, there are no fathers. Stop preaching to me and let me do the preaching. You listen. See, what changed from when you were an infant to growing up to learn mother or father? Your understanding, isn't it? Were they not, before you understood that they were your mother and father, that, you know, were they not still your parents? They were. Were they any less your parents before you knew them as your parents? Any less? 1%? 0.5%? No. They were 100% your mother and father before you understood them as such, and 100% your mother and father after you understood them as such. After you realized that they were mother and father, did they treat you any differently? Did they love you more now that you know them as mother and father? No, that never changed. So it's the same concept here. The same concept here. I'm trying to show you with something you really, really, really understand. This new concept. It's not really a new concept. You just need to apply what you already know into something you don't know. You are already 100% nature, both physically and mentally. Your body is 100% nature. Every single strand of hair on your head. Yes, Swami says also. To your last toe. From head to toe, 100% of you is nature. That is the physical aspect of it. What remains is the mental aspect. Your chittas that arise and pass away. What about them? Are they also not nature? What percentage of that is nature? So what is a chitta? Vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana. If you consider rupa also, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana. What percentage of rupa is nature? 100%. Vedana? Yeah. Put it this way. What percentage of rupa is natural? 100%. Right? Others you could say it's 20% of nature, which would also be a right answer, because the other 80% would be vedana, sanya, and so on. But if you just take rupa alone, if this was rupa, what percentage of this is nature? 100% of it is nature. Vedana, sanya, sankara, and vijnana. So when you consider all five of them together, now you have covered both the physical aspect and the mental aspect. So 100% of you is nature. Where's the problem? Understanding. That's the problem. Understanding. You only learn to love your mother when you realize that she was your mother. Until then, you had some form of connection, but you just knew it as the person who provides for me. You know, there's a time in an infant's life where they begin to understand mother and father. It's not the day they start saying Amma. That's the day they start actually, you know, uttering some words and, you know, getting something out of their vocal system. But it's not that day. It happens before that. They begin to understand that this is my mother, there's something special here. This is my father, there's something special here. I have a special connection, a special bond with them. That goes beyond the biological bond. So once you begin to understand that, now that special bond begins to form. And now you're happy with them. You see, no matter where you go, where do you always want to come back? What's that word? Four-letter word. H. Home. Because who's at home? Ammian. Tata. O amman. Tata. O amman. Appachi. O mamman. Dad. That's why you always want to come back home. No matter where you go. Far across the oceans, travel the lands, travel the continents, no matter where you go, you're always looking forward to that day when you can get back on a flight and come back home to be with your mother and father. Why? Because there's a very special bond there. A very special bond. That's why, you know, your mother and father passing away is not like when a friend passes away. Because that's a very special bond. It's not like an uncle passing away, or an aunt, or a distant relation, or a cousin passing away. It's not the same. When it's time your mother and father has to leave you, it almost feels like half of you is dead. The other half somehow seems to remain, and that is you, but the other half is dead. It feels like that. If you among the audience have gone through this experience, then you know what I'm talking about. The day you had to say farewell to your parents. It's a very special bond. So no matter where you go, you come back home, because that's where, as you say, the heart is. In other words, that's where your mother and father are. But that special bond only formed after you began to understand that they were mother and father. Until then, no such thing. If as an infant, you were taken away, maybe you were as foster parents, they adopted you. You were a foster child. They took you and adopted you, and now two other people you call mother and father. That bond would not have formed with your parents. Now let's just think. I'm trying to give you this analogy so you can understand what I was trying to explain earlier. Say you were adopted as a young child. You didn't know that it happened, right? So they took you when you were just an infant or very young age. Now your foster parents are looking after you. After a while, your biological parents, they come to see you. Okay? They've not disclosed to you that they are your biological parents, but when they see you, you know, they are just drowned with love and affection towards you, just overwhelmed with love and affection, and they just come and hug you and embrace you and start kissing you. What are you going to feel? Now, you don't know that these are your parents. What are you going to feel? You're going to feel really weird, right? What's going on? You're going to push them away. Leave me alone. What are you doing? Child molesters? You'd feel like something's wrong. You might even call the police on your parents. But you don't know that these are your parents. So this might happen for a few minutes. And then maybe your adopted parents will say, "Whoa, hold on. They are your biological parents." Huh? What? What would you do after that? Would you not reciprocate what your parents did just a moment ago? You would go and hug them, maybe get them on the floor. See, that's what happens when you learn that nature, you are nature. Nature is always trying to embrace you. Nature is always trying to take you into her arms. Nature is always saying, "You are my child, come to me. Let's arise and pass away together." Nature is always saying that. Nature is saying, "Here, I feel, let me give you the lifeblood. Let me give you energy. Integrate with me. Unite with me. Come to me, my child." But you don't accept them as mother and father. You don't accept nature as mother and father because you have yet to realize. Therefore, what do people do? They fight. They fight back. They reject nature. When nature says arise, they say, no, I don't want to arise. Now, friction, conflict, suffering. When nature says, let's pass away, then the untamed, the unrealized mind says, no, don't want to pass away, I want to be like this. See, nature is trying to embrace you. They're trying to give you that maternal embrace, but we're not ready because we have yet to recognize and realize that we are also nature, just like the child has to realize that they are the biological children of those parents. And once that happens, you just fall into their embrace. Then they don't feel like strangers. You know, ladies and gentlemen, until you understand the Dhamma, you feel like nature is a stranger to you. Don't you agree? That's why when it rains, you look up in the sky and go, damn, it's raining again. Oh, how I wish it could be sunny today. When a stranger knocks on your door, how do you feel? Do you open the door and welcome them in and open, you know, hug them and give, embrace them with open arms? You don't, because they're strangers, right? But when a good friend walks in through the door, you welcome them, take them in, sit them down, right? You know, treat them, greet them, hospitality, all that. So today, nature decides, I'm going to rain. You decide, no, I want it to be sunny today. Now what happens? Conflict. Friction. You treat nature like a stranger. But the irony of it is, you are also nature. And so when nature decides today is going to be a sunny day, and you want it to rain, you're a farmer, your crops have been withering away, it needs to be watered now, and you're looking for rain. What does nature want to do with the crops? Huh? What does nature want to do with the crops? Exactly what's happening right now. If, you know, if there's a tree at home, say your apple tree. Do you have an apple tree? No, we are in Sri Lanka, we don't have apple trees. We have pineapple trees, right? Let's say you have a jackfruit tree, right? It was your great-grandfather who planted that. Right? Now it's a tall and majestic jackfruit tree. It has always bore fruit and it has fed your family for generations. It has been the icon of your family. Right? Everyone calls your home the tree, the home with the jackfruit tree. Kosgaha Gedara. That's what they call your home. Right? That has been the symbol of your home. So you have taken a strong attachment to it and you feel like, you know, that has to be there forever and forever and forever. One day nature decides, you know what, that's enough. The skies begin to darken. The clouds swing into action. You can hear the thunder. And out of nowhere comes a lightning bolt. Of all the places it could strike. There's the old mango tree that your ex-wife planted. Why can't it strike that? Huh? Of all the places it could strike, where does it strike? The jackfruit tree. It strikes the tree and it blows it up into smithereens. Now it's a dead tree. It can no longer bear fruit. Nature has decided that it is time. To you, the jackfruit tree is a friend. That lightning bolt is a stranger. Because to you, you don't accept nature as your friend. Because you are yet to become nature. Therefore, you treat nature as a stranger. So when nature decides it's time to strike, now what happens? You suffer. Oh, my jackfruit tree. For 75 years it stood there, bearing fruit and feeding the family. Maybe 175 years. No, you don't have jackfruit trees that last that long, right? 7,500 years it stood there, bearing fruit and fed the family. But alas, and people start crying. But nature has decided that that is what needs to happen. So, you know, if your plantation, you know, if you are a farmer, you have a paddy field, right? And it has not been raining for the last 3 months. I understand there are people who are hungry, right? The grain prices will start going up. The economy will be affected. People will start to feel the pain of a famine, right? All this is going to happen. But that is what nature wants. When it's time to die, doesn't nature take you? What can you do to fight that? What can you do to defy that? What can you do? There's nothing you can do. But then there are two types of people who respond differently in the face of death. There are some who cry, and there are some who smile. Does nature treat them differently? Does nature kill one more than it does the other? One is a brutal death. The other is a very gentle, kind death. Does nature do that? No, when nature decides it's time to take you, nature is going to take you, whether you've been a good man or a bad man. Yeah, whether you have been a sinner or a saint, when nature decides it's time to take you, nature takes you. But then why do some people cry in the face of death and why do others smile in the face of death? Because when nature comes, it depends on your attitude to nature. If you have realized as the Buddha did, now you become friends with nature, you become one with nature, you become God. Who created death? See, you say God created life. Yeah, so God creates life, He takes away life when He decides. Yeah, I ask you the question. Who created life for you? What is life after all? It's just vipaka. Vipaka energy that comes to fruition. Yeah, so who created that? Yourself. What is death? Death in the way that we understand today is the separating of mind and body. But ultimate death, meaning parinibbana. Yeah, that is also, because in other religions they say, you know, when death happens, you either reunite with God forever. That is forever, or you are damned for a long time in the hell until judgment day. You know, different religions have different interpretations, but to keep it quite simple, you know, that's a basic principle. But if you created your coming into this world, and Nibbana is also your creation, you see, I can't do Nibbana for you. The Buddha can't do Nibbana for you. Your Nibbana is done by whom? By you yourself. Then who is your creator? And who is your destroyer? So if Lord Shiva is the creator and the destroyer of the world, then who are you? It is not I who said that. I believe in what he says. You know, these scriptures, they have such depth. When Lord Shiva opens his third eye, what happens? The world is destroyed. When does your world destroy? When you open your third eye. Yes. Open your two eyes and the world is created. That's how Lord Shiva created the world. He opened his eyes and he created the world. He opened his third eye one day and the world will be destroyed. How are you going to destroy your world? By opening your third eye. How did you create the world? By opening your two eyes. Yes, agreed. So don't you believe in Hinduism? Yes, it is true. He is the creator and he is the destroyer. Yes. Hello, Lord Shiva. Right, time's up for today. So, in a few minutes, you'll all be joining the procession up to the stupa, where the last puja will be done, the last offering. And if you haven't deposited your copper leaves, you will have the opportunity to do that. In these copper leaves, I hope you have inscribed the ways in which you have benefited from the Buddha Sasana. If you haven't had a chance to grab a copper leaf yet, then please, you can request one from the Dhamma Hall. They'll be more than happy to give you one. In there, inscribe what the Sasana has done for you. Swagatam Vatamiyasi. Mama Guru Himi Santiki. That's my version of it. So you inscribe what the Sasana has done for you. Because on your quest to becoming Shiva and opening your third eye, this is going to help you. So that every day as you walk in through these gates, you look up at the stupa and you bring your hands together in veneration. Remind yourself that it is that ultimate bliss that you're after. Because the chaitya has to happen within your hearts. That is where the Buddha is going to be born. It is a representation. That's why it matters not whether these are just fragments of glass or just, you know, rose stones. Matters not. Matters not. We are not going to go and do DNA checks or carbon dating to find out whether they are the genuine, authentic relics. Then we should do the same with this also. Then why do we offer flowers? Why do we offer the pan? No point, right? It's not so. Even if you create a mound of sand or soil and worship it, that brings you merits because the virtue is not in the sand, it's not in the soil, therefore it's not in the relic. It's not in the relic. It's within you. It's the qualities that you must always venerate, the virtues that you must always venerate. And they are universal. The Buddha is everywhere. The Dhamma is everywhere. The Sangha, everywhere. These qualities are everywhere. So what are we trying to do? We are trying to instill them in our minds. Where do we get it from? Nature. That's what I said. It's everywhere. We just have to realize. Open your eyes and realize. Let's do the merit transfer and bring the sermon to an end. Let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired. By making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, inviting the Swami Namastas to deliver the sermon today, inviting your friends and family to join us and listen to the sermon, reflecting on the Dhamma, chanting Pirit, meditating, chanting the Buddha Guna and so on. Let us first and foremost take this opportunity to remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer all these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let's not forget that amongst them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who've always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to our teacher, Guru Hamdaran Wahanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes, and medicines, as well as extend their know-how and well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and employees, our elders and our teachers, and everyone who's made every effort in their power to help us, support and assist us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. Out of gratitude in all our hearts, let us take a moment to transfer these merits to all of them. May, by the power of these merits, they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the Nimas gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our name, our forefathers, our ancestors, our loved ones, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the armed forces and the police force who sacrifice their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe, as well as those who have lost their lives in natural disasters such as the tsunamis and earthquakes and landslides, forest fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinite long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, friends and acquaintances to us. They'll have gone the extra mile on every occasion on our behalf out of compassion, loving kindness and gratitude towards all of them. Let us transfer all the merits that we have acquired to all of them. May, by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may, by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a rahatan vahanse or an arahat teranin vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you. Raga kinnen midetva, dvesha kinnen midetva, moha kinnen midetva, Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Raga gini niveva, dvesha gini niveva, moha gini niveva, nivansapa labeva,
නිවන් සැප ලැබේවා. නිවන් සැප ලැබේවා. තුනුරුවන්ගේ සූසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බැලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුගතිතර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.